Lots of the stories coming out of contemporary football are decidedly grim. Players have endured brain injuries, and they've been medicated so they could play when they shouldn't have been playing. Notre Dame is only the most recent big-time college program where suspicions of academic impropriety have surfaced. But according to Dave Revson, whose new book is titled The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation, there is precedent for these stories. Dave Revson, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks, Bill.
Among the more passionate of the game's opponents during football's early days was one Henry McCracken. He was New York University's chancellor from 1891 to 1910, and he said, quote, "Deaths and injuries are not the strongest argument against football. That cheating and brutality are profitable is the main evil." Was that assessment prompted by any particular episode?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that went on that McCracken kind of oversaw. There was a death on the field in a game that NYU was involved in, which I think really scarred him. There were a lot of people who were opposed to football in this time period that I covered, which is 1890 to 1915, but they were kind of in different camps, and there were some who believed that it was the death on the field that was the issue, and there were others, and McCracken would be one of them. President Roosevelt was another one who believed there was deception involved in the game, more so kind of the brutality at the line of scrimmage rather than people actually dying, that there was kind of an underhanded nature of the game. There were different camps of objection, and I think to a certain extent there still are today.
In football's formative years, players were regularly compensated for their efforts. What were some of the more creative ways colleges and universities did that?
You had literally people going on streetcars and offering people a wage to play for a day. You had very famous cases of players going from school to school. They were called tramp athletes. For instance, Fielding Yost, who went on to great fame as the head coach of Michigan. Yost was playing at West Virginia and went to play one game for Lafayette. They pulled a huge upset over Penn. He played that game, and a week later, he was back on campus at West Virginia playing for them. When I talk about the Michigan team in 1893, 7 of their 11 players weren't enrolled in school, weren't students at the University of Michigan. And yet people didn't find that to be strange, because part of what they were trying to figure out in this time period was, well, who should be able to represent these schools?
A tackle named Frank Hanley, who played for Notre Dame in 1896, was perhaps especially forthcoming about why he was in South Bend when he was asked, "What did you take in college?"
Yeah, his response was baths. you just kind of leave it at that, right? But I think it points to a larger issue, which is there's been this constant tug of war, as you know, between the academic side and the athletic side of a university. And I think that Hanley's example maybe elucidates it more clearly than any that I could point out.
You have to really admire his candor.
Either that, or you just have to marvel at his cluelessness.
Maybe both.
That he really believed that was the thrust of the question.
During the 1890s, heavyweight boxing champion John L. Sullivan witnessed a game between Yale and Harvard, and his comment on the action is, I think, worth recalling.
Yeah, he ran into Paul Daschle, who was a well-known official of the game. They were in a restroom on a train, and Daschle asked him what he thought of the game, and Sullivan lowered his voice to a whisper and said, "There's murder in that game."
This is the heavyweight champion of the world.
Exactly. I mean, it points out just how violent the sport was. And I think to a lot of people, it just seemed like it was almost violence for violence's sake. And it really was in a crisis.
There are lighter episodes in the opening kickoff. Tell us, if you will, how fans in New Haven got their play-by-play for the 1893 Thanksgiving Day game between Yale and Princeton.
Basically, they'd set up a telegraph line. Results would be of each play would be conveyed. And then they had these kind of suspended puppets on wires, and they would move the puppets to indicate who had the ball and which direction they were moving in. And it's crazy, but I mean, they're sitting there in New Haven. They're 75 miles away from New York City, where Yale and Princeton were playing in front of 50,000 people. And Yale had won 37 games in a row. And when Princeton scored, ended up winning the game, and they talk about the gasps when the Princeton puppet was moved over the goal line.
A lot of your history of football's early days focuses on the playing career and the later life of one Pat O'Day, who played for Wisconsin. What made him such a fascinating character?
Relative to the day, he was covered in the same breathless way that Johnny Manziel is, including lots of discussions about a particular female companion, Dame Nellie Melba. People who watch Downton Abbey know about her, maybe the most famous female performer in the world at that time. There were issues with his academic eligibility. The university president at Wisconsin pushed him through. He was a great superstar, one of the first stars of the area that I live in and cover, the Midwest, at a time when the East absolutely dominated college football. But I just thought that O'Day spoke to kind of this broader idea, this need that we have for superstardom, and then all of these different elements which combined, I think, make college football so fascinating.
I also like the idea that some of the early stars, if they weren't paid directly with cash, they were told, well, you can have all the money that we make selling tobacco.
You think about the O'Bannon case, which was such a huge issue and still is, right, about your name, image, and likeness. I mean, there was a guy who played at Yale, James Hogan, who had a deal with the American Tobacco Company. They sold cigarettes on campus with his name attached to them, and he got a percentage of the sales in New Haven. And again, I mean, the parallels are just stunning. Everything we're going through now in this sport, the beginnings of it could be seen in this prior time period.
Dave Revson is lead studio anchor for the Big Ten Network and the author of The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation. He joined me from WBEZ in Chicago, and you can read an excerpt from his book at onlyagame.org. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, Bill, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.